G'day, Cameron Wilson with you. This is Bush Telegraph on RN and Radio Australia. Today, what role should secret footage play in stopping animal cruelty? Can it be legally used to bring court cases against intensive farms? This week, a New South Wales piggery faced animal cruelty charges that were laid after activists publicly released covert footage. So coming up, the RSPCA on the role of activists and secret cameras. Also ahead, a good news story from the Goulburn Valley with a cider maker coming to the rescue of one grower who was about to bulldoze his trees. And you'll meet Gump, the last living skink of her kind on Christmas Island. This is a fascinating story about yet another Australian animal that's critically endangered. We start today with Tony Abbott's vision for a free trade deal with China.
Australia has a strong relationship with China, and it's in everyone's interest that that relationship grows stronger and broader and deeper in the months and years ahead.
Well, it turns out that the PM has ambitions for the earlier part of that time frame. He was speaking at this week's APEC summit in Bali, where he met with Chinese President Xi Jinping. And he announced he'll soon be leading a delegation to China with the aim of freeing up trade between the two countries in the next 12 months. So, what can Australia achieve within that time frame? Let's look into it with Dr. Geoffrey Wilson. He's a fellow at the Asia Research Centre at Murdoch University and a specialist in economic relations between Australia and countries in Asia. Geoffrey, good morning.
Good morning, Cameron. How are you going?
Good, good. From Australia's perspective, what kind of barriers to free trade exist at the moment with China?
One of the major barriers to Australian trade with China is a number of forms of protection in the agricultural sector, particularly tariffs that China applies on Australian agricultural exports to the country. So these are effectively a tax that raises the price of a product like Australian sugar or beef or wheat in the Chinese market.
So Australia's been in free trade talks with China for 8 years now. What progress has been made in that time?
They began in 2005, and since that time, not a lot has been achieved. There's been 17 rounds of negotiation so far, and these have been on and off, and there have been delays in the process and stalls and various declarations that the talks would be restarted and finished very soon. Unfortunately, a lot of the discussions are still going on around some fairly basic issues to do with what products are going to be included in the free trade agreement and what products will be left out. So this is a discussion defining the scope of the agreement, and this has to be decided even before you get to the point of exchanging offers about, well, we'll change this tariff or we'll change that tariff by X amount.
Okay. Let's just go back to the APEC summit for a moment. Here's more from Tony Abbott on his vision for a free trade agreement with China.
I want the agreement to be as comprehensive as possible, but I've always taken the view that you should take what you can get today and pitch for the rest tomorrow when you've got a strong foundation to build upon. So we'll get the best deal we can. I can't at this stage say that it's going to include everything. If it doesn't include everything, that will be a disappointment, but still, whatever we can get, which is a substantial advance on where we are, is worth having.
Dr. Geoffrey Wilson, at this stage in the negotiations, what can the federal government realistically achieve with China in the next 12 months?
Well, up until this point, Australia has asked for what it refers to as a comprehensive agreement. So this would liberalise agricultural trade across a whole range of commodities we have an interest in. Particular ones are beef, sugar, some coarse grains, horticultural products, lamb, wool and wine. Unfortunately, this has been, in effect, is asking too much. And it's become clear for most observers that if Australia would ask for slightly less, so it would pick out certain industries and say, well, these ones we really see as a core interest and these other ones we're okay to accept from the agreement, then that would make it a lot easier to advance these negotiations.
So the federal government will need to pick winners and also pick losers.
This is probably what this is going to imply. Now, there's been a number of discussions over the last few weeks as to who would be the winners and who would be the losers, so to speak. Australia's former ambassador to China, Jeff Raby, recently suggested that one of the key interests that we should push forward is the beef industry, and suggested that the sugar industry was one that we might not be able to get much traction on. Now, I'm not entirely sure which industries are in and which are out, and this is a matter for some discussion. Indeed, it was reported overnight that the new Trade Minister, Andrew Robb, is currently looking at these issues and deciding, well, what can we prioritise and what we can't at the moment. So it's it's clear a decision hasn't been yet made. But what will have to happen is some prioritisation of certain interests and, by extension, deprioritisation of others is going to have to occur.
So what dictates who goes to the front of the queue?
Well, this is a difficult question to answer. Part of the assessment would be in what areas does China feel the most sensitive? So is there certain agricultural industries in which China would find it more difficult to liberalise agricultural trade than others? So I guess you would call that picking the low-hanging fruit. Mm-hmm. And in other senses, this will also do with assessments of what Australia's economic interests are in terms of which industries for us are the most important export industries where we see there could be a growth market.
So would China be looking to protect some of its areas based on economic value or cultural value?
There's, to an extent, some of China's agricultural protectionist policies are actually designed as a kind of a food security measure. In many Chinese farmers live in rural areas, they're quite poor, and they're living in under very close to subsistence levels. And so these forms of agricultural protection, which in effect raise local prices for foods and grains, are a form of kind of support for these very poor rural farmers. So I'd expect China to be looking particularly at those industries as areas that would be very difficult to make concessions on. In other areas which are less closely connected to that, perhaps for premium products such as fruit and vegetables or, say, beef, high-value products consumed by wealthy middle-class consumers in China's cities, in those areas, those kind of urban poverty and food security issues are less pressing, and so China might be more willing to move in those sectors.
Mm. You referred to some of Jeff Raby's comments earlier and said that sugar could potentially miss out. Why does sugar seem to often be the loser when it comes to free trade agreements? I'm thinking back to the US negotiations several years back.
This is a particularly difficult issue. I'm not entirely sure. One of the issues is sugar is a very large global industry, and a lot of countries have a lot of production in this. Particularly, there's also a lot of, in a country like China, a lot of smallhold farmers who could be particularly affected by a flood of Australian sugar coming in. If you look at other agricultural products that Australia exports, such as beef, wine, some horticultural products, fruit and vegetables, there's often not important that these are kind of the production of these commodities is of less domestic importance. So it's easier to say open up your industry for eggplant exports, for one example, than it is to take sugar from.
Yeah. Mm. Wool has Australia's wool industry has relied heavily on exports to China in recent years. Has there been any indication on where wool might fit in these negotiations?
There's been a lot of discussion in some of the press and around the lobby groups who are involved in these discussions with the government around this as to which industry should be in and which industry should be out. Now, over the last 10 years or so, Chinese demand for Australian fine wool and superfine wool has grown quite considerably. This is because Australian wool is a premium product. And increasingly, as China's textile mills and its clothing industry move up the value chain into higher value products and increasingly start competing with major textile producers like Italy, for example, in men's suits, there is increasing demand for Australian wool, fine wool in China. And so this has been a good news story. However, some of the commentary that I've seen coming out over the last few weeks is that wool may not be able to be achieved in these negotiations. But again, this is speculation. And as I said, the formal decisions are yet to be made and are up for negotiation over the next 12 months.
All right. We'll learn more about the winners and the losers over the next year. Thanks, Jeffrey. Nice talking to you.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Wilson is a fellow of the Asia Research Centre at Murdoch University. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. Well, what might happen if Australia is successful in securing a free trade agreement with China? Well, New Zealand gave its dairy industry a boost in 2008 when it became the first country to sign an FTA with China. Kimberly Cruther is the Executive Director of the Dairy Company Association of New Zealand and joins me now. Hi, Kimberly. You've had the New Zealand FTA with China in place for 5 years now. How soon did the dairy industry start to see the benefits flow?
I think it's fair to say there have been a range of benefits that have come out of the FTA with China for the New Zealand dairy industry, and those vary from tariff reductions, or tariff elimination processes, which are still being phased in and will be phased in for a number of years to come. But also there was immediate benefits in terms of building the familiarity between the two countries, including in terms of the business environment there.
So how important are exports to China now to New Zealand dairy farmers?
China is one of the major markets for New Zealand dairy exports, so it's a very important market for us.
What sort of products?
Mainly in the milk powders, which of course the New Zealand dairy industry's production is tends towards, and that's where we've seen at the same time as trade has been liberalised, or the FTA has been concluded for between China and New Zealand, there's also been significant growth in demand within China for those products, not just because of the FTA, but rather because of internal demographic trends and dietary trends within China.
The move towards more Western-style fast food, for instance.
Yes.
Yeah. How has the business relationship changed between the New Zealand industry and the Chinese dairy industry?
We've seen a strengthening of the business relationship. We often say that we expect investment to follow trade, and that's definitely happened with New Zealand dairy producers investing locally within China, and of course that's also happened with Chinese companies investing within the New Zealand industry itself.
What, buying farms or investing in factories and processing?
Investing in factories and processing in New Zealand, and with Fonterra having large-scale investments in farms within China.
Okay, yeah, we've seen in the news these relatively big Fonterra farms that have seen the trade in live cows as well as the investment flow as well. Is there a sense that New Zealand benefited from being first cab off the rank, so to speak, in terms of free trade agreements with China?
I think there are always benefits from any trade liberalisation, but being first cab off the rank, as you say, has had a benefit. Of course, other countries who follow New Zealand in agreeing free trade agreements with China may have shorter or different phase and timeframes than we have had.
Is there any sense that Australia pursuing a free trade agreement with China would threaten New Zealand in any way?
I think generally we support increased trade liberalisation across the board. We have strong and existing relationships between the New Zealand industry and the Chinese industry now, and so no, we don't see it as a threat.
Kimberly, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Kimberly Crutha, Executive Director of the Dairy Companies Association of New Zealand, just giving us a bit of a taste of how the free trade agreement with New Zealand, between New Zealand and China, has affected the dairy industry over there. You're listening to Bush Telegraph on RN. In New South Wales, piggery has been charged with aggravated animal cruelty. The farm at Murrum Bateman was raided last year by police and the RSPCA, and that led to a hearing this week of 53 charges, with the case to resume in December. What's interesting about this case is that the RSPCA raided the piggery after animal rights group Animal Liberation leaked footage of the farm. It highlights the increasingly important role that's being played by activists in detecting and then publicising what they claim are acts of animal cruelty. To discuss this more, I'm joined by the Chief Inspector with the New South Wales RSPCA, David O'Shaughnessy. Hi, David.
Good morning, Cameron.
Just quickly on the facts of this case, what is the piggery actually being accused of exactly?
I guess we can't talk too much about the details, but at this stage the RSPCA allege that there have been 12 acts of aggravated cruelty committed, 12 charges of failing to provide veterinary treatment to various numbers of pigs, and 29 counts of failing to comply with the conditions of an animal trade, being a commercial pig establishment.
Okay. You investigated after Animal Liberation leaked footage from hidden cameras on the property. Was the RSPCA interested in the practices at this piggery prior to that?
The RSPCA hadn't received any complaints about practices at this piggery prior to us receiving complaints in August last year.
So would you have served the court attendance notices without this footage?
It's possible that an inspection may not have been conducted, and we may not have known about what was happening on this particular piggery had, I guess, the information not come to light publicly.
So from the RSPCA's point of view, is secret footage at this piggery or anywhere else, generally speaking now, is that helpful?
I guess it's not really helpful. It's important that animal welfare offences, if detected, are brought to the attention of the appropriate bodies. I guess the problems with this secret footage and the way it was captured is there were a number of offences, potential offences depicted in this footage, and as a consequence of the manner in which the footage was obtained, we were not able to take action on those incidences.
Because what, you can't use that footage in your case?
That's the problem. We attempted to obtain statements from the people that we believe are responsible for capturing the images. We were unable to get any witness statements in that regard, so we were unable to use the evidence.
So you can't use the evidence, but is it fair to say that the footage did trigger the investigation?
The RSPCA received a complaint on the back of the footage being made public, yes.
Mm. Are there concerns then that when footage like this triggers an investigation that it encourages animal welfare activists to do this again in future and potentially trespass on farms?
It is concerning that those incidents do occur. I guess if there are incidents of cruelty out there and people are aware of that, they'd be well encouraged to contact one of the bodies under the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act that have the authority to investigate those complaints and take action. The concern is, there's a whole lot of biosecurity concerns and issues in that regard when people enter properties illegally. If they become aware of animal welfare concerns, they should be reporting them.
So the RSPCA would take the same action with or without the footage if there was a complaint made, would it?
If the RSPCA had received a complaint about this property, we would have conducted an inspection, which we did, and as a consequence, there are the 53 charges currently before court.
Mm. Does it concern you that it seems to be something of a trend amongst some welfare groups to obtain this sort of footage, in some instances hold on to it for some time, and then release it publicly?
I guess it is a concern, depending on the length of time that people have been aware of incidences of cruelty. Had that been reported earlier, action could have been taken earlier, and the issues of animal welfare addressed.
David, thank you for telling us what you can about this case and the issue more broadly today.
Not a problem. Thanks very much.
David O'Shaughnessy is the Chief Inspector with the New South Wales RSPCA, and on Friday we'll be having a much more in-depth discussion about the ethics and technology of the kind of surveillance involved in some of these cases and others like the one we were just discussing there. So that's on Friday on Bush Telegraph. Get to rural news with Tony Allen in a moment, but a 500ml bottle of pear cider has just been dropped in the studio. In a few minutes' time, I'm going to test it out. I'm told that this could be one of the ways that fruit growers in the Goulburn Valley of Victoria might be making a living in the future, and this might even stop them from pulling out some of their fruit trees. So I can see Tony Allen's eyes lighting up right now. There's a few glasses there, Tony, so you might even get a taste yourself.
I like pear cider, and there's a very long history to pear cider. I think it's called Perry.
Perry, you're right. Yeah. Yep, spot on. And apparently, normally, if you want to get a brand of product like this off the ground, it takes a very long time. But this one was got up in a matter of weeks.
And they make quite a bit of it in New Zealand as well. And it's catching on amongst the younger folk.
Mm, okay, so stay with us for more on Perry. You've got some drought news. First, we had an extensive story on the Queensland drought yesterday. Calls for more drought aid on the back of that?
Yes, the rural lobby group AgForce, which represents a lot of Queensland farmers, say the Queensland government has been pretty generous with drought assistance, but more is needed. And they've written a letter to the State Agriculture Minister John McVeigh with an assistance wish list. Now, some of the extra things they want more people to be eligible to be helped by the assistance, and also a range of activities like desilting dams mm-hmm. should be claimable as drought measures. It's a bit of a grey area, so to speak, but that's what they want. And they also, the president of AgForce, Ian Burnett, says the Drought Relief Assistance Scheme, which has offered $20,000 for fodder assistance, needs to be boosted.
We're getting reports that $20,000 doesn't quite cover it, and if they could just get a bit more money. So that's why our request, an extra $10,000 $1,000 there, on the advice that we're getting, will cover most situations as it currently stands.
And now Mr. McVeigh says he will review the level of drought aid but makes no promises, and the Federal Agriculture Minister Barnaby Joyce is going to inspect the drought regions later this week.
Miriam Hall, a reporter, told us yesterday 60% of Queensland is currently drought declared, and that could raise to 80% in the next couple of weeks. So really severe situation in Queensland at the moment. Maybe not drought declared in South Australia, but tell you what, it's hot.
They've had pretty good rain in South Australia, which is just as well, because today the temperature could hit 41 degrees in some parts of the wheat belt, and it's a total fire ban across most of the state. Agronomist Richard Saunders from Loxton in the Mallee says some of the crops are going to be under stress, particularly the barley varieties that are particularly vulnerable to high winds, which are also forecast.
If the crop is at the right stage and the wind hits it from the right direction and it gets enough of a belting from the wind, it can severely impact the yield.
Okay.
Let's hope things cool down pretty quickly.
Yeah, okay. We'll find out later in the year how that crop shapes up. Problems of a different kind in WA, I think it is, where they've got some thieves pinching fuel.
Yes, we're always being warned about gangs. Well, in Western Australia, they're warning about gangs of fuel thieves during seeding and harvest times, which are coming up in WA.
Yeah.
Harvest. Fuel thieves target the grain growers who often leave the machinery or their fuel tanks out in paddocks overnight, for obvious reasons. Mark Gabagni from police in York in the Wheat Belt says, next to stock theft, stealing fuel, particularly diesel, is the most common rural crime in the Wheat Belt.
Some people just drive along and all of a sudden they'll see this trailer sitting in the paddock with no one else around. The farmer's knocked off for the night and they'll seize on that opportunity to take the fuel. And then there's that group that actually will drive around with a larger tank on the back of a larger vehicle and actually start siphoning off those few thousand litres here and there.
So if you see any late night siphoning, let the cops know.
How brazen is that? Just park next to the fuel tank and siphon a few thousand litres off.
There's plenty of it around, and petrol prices and diesel prices are pretty high.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to chat cider later in the program. I'll let you go, Tony. Drop by if you want to test it out. Tony Allen with the latest there in rural news. If you want to go to the website, the Bush Telly website, you can find a National Rural News tab there and keep up to date right throughout the day.
Do you have a story about a secret?
I looked deep into my soul and saw exactly who I was.
Be a part of RN's Pocket Docs competition. By writing or recording a true story about a secret, the best written story wins an iPad mini, while the best audio story wins a digital recorder.
No one could actually identify him, even though a lot of people said looks like.
Pocket Docs, a secret revealed. Oh, and you have to mention something you can fit into a pocket. Head to the RN homepage for all the details.
You are on RN and Radio Australia. Cameron Wilson with you for Bush Telly. Just before we discuss Perry and why some Goulburn Valley fruit growers in Victoria are hoping Perry might be the income of their future, I want to talk a little bit about prize-winning pigeons and the attributes that that a prize-winning pigeon has. It has to be shaped like a champagne flute. That's one thing I know about them. Clint Jasper visited the poultry shed at the Loxton Show to find out more about what it takes to breed a champion pigeon.
Hello, I'm Orb Schutz. I breed utility pigeons.
How did you get started pigeon breeding?
I was 50 years ago I started, walking to primary school and found a homing pigeon in a channel, big open channel for the fruit blocks. And I took it home to my dad and he said, oh, that's a cockbird. And he said, I'll get you a female. And I don't know where he got it from, but he got me a female one and I started from there. And by the time I'd left primary school, I had about 11 different varieties of pigeons, but I still never had the real big ones, which I got now.
I guess most people only think of pigeons as, you know, a species in themselves. How many types of pigeons are there?
You look at it, there's hundreds. And varieties, like the utilities that I've got six different varieties of the utility, which are the biggest pigeons. I haven't got any small pigeons, as you can see around here today.
They're all pretty big.
Yeah. And the strange part, the ones that I mainly do are the runts, which you would think was the smallest, but they're the biggest.
Why do you breed pigeons?
Just as a hobby. And I guess I like it. And it gives you something to do. It's pretty interesting. And plus, when you go to shows, you meet all other mates that, you know, talk about pigeons and stuff like that. Yeah.
How many pigeon breeders are there? Is it a big community?
Yeah, there's in the Riverland here, we've probably half a dozen of his main ones. But when you get down towards Adelaide, you know, and all the surrounding districts, there's heaps. But the thing is, not a lot of young people are taking it on today. That's the biggest problem. Most of us guys, you know, getting in 50s, 60s, 70s, and even in our 80s are still showing because they love doing it.
So tell me about the winning pigeon here.
Well, the winning one is the a White King. They got to look more or less like a champagne glass, shaped like a champagne glass. And you see, it's not standing on one leg, which it is now. It would be shaped like that. And size, got to have your size. There's all sorts of different features, the nice head, the red around the eyes and all things like that you look for.
You mentioned before not many young people are getting into it. How do you think you could attract more young people into pigeon breeding as a hobby?
Well, a lot of us try, and I've even given some young kids, but I guess feathered birds aren't as good as the other birds, are they? Non-feathered. I've got three boys, and they've all started off with birds when they were young, and the same thing. Once they get a bit older, they go away from the feathered type and get the other ones.
Orb Schutz, who's the owner of the Loxton Show's winning pigeon. Good on you, Orb. He was speaking there to our reporter, Clint Jasper. Stay with us. We've got a really interesting story coming up later in the program. It's about Gump. She's the last lizard of her kind, last known lizard of her kind on Christmas Island, which is quite a sad story, actually, but it's an interesting one nonetheless. So hang around for that. Now to the product that could stop fruit growers in northern Victoria from having to pull up some of their trees. The growers are planning to launch a pear cider this week using wasted fruit, I guess, and the talents of a rather hastily assembled team of helpers. Shortly, you'll be hearing from the brewer about the challenges of developing this product in such a short time frame. But first, Dario Pulsoni is one of the growers, and he joins me now. Hi, Dario.
Hello, how are you?
Good, good, good. Now, you've got a familiar story, haven't you, about losing your contract. What happened?
Yes, as a lot of other growers have this year, I was told last year that my pears would no longer be required. So I sort of had started finding homes for my fruit earlier on, but a lot of growers this year have been told that they no longer want their fruit required.
This is SBC, that's correct. So what, in the past your pears would have gone into tins and sold in the supermarkets around Australia?
The canning, exactly, yes. Yeah. Yep.
All right, so what was going to happen to these pears that you've been growing for quite some time?
It was starting to look like we might have to start pulling some blocks out because it was becoming too much supply in the fresh market. Obviously, the cannery wasn't taking them, so people were putting them into the fresh market, and it was becoming too oversupplied, and obviously the prices weren't getting what we should have. So, people were starting to...
You're thinking about getting the bulldozer in?
Yeah, exactly.
You'd had to do that once before, hadn't you?
Well, we have, yeah. Not so much me, but my father had pulled pears out years ago, yes, yeah. Yeah.
All right, which is not what you want to do. So you came up with this idea of pear cider. How did that come about?
It's been something, I suppose, in the back of my mind for a while, but it was sort of, I had some fruit in the cool room that would probably normally have gone to the cannery for very minimal price, and we sort of become associated with the GV Food Co-op. We have a retail premises in town, and they approach us to help them sell their first product that they launched. And just talking to my wife in the shop, they were looking for another product to move on to.
Yeah.
So I said to my wife, well, look, if you're talking to them, tell them I've got some fruit there that's available. They can have it and do what they like with it, if they could find something to do with it.
As long as they make money out of it, eh?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Stay with us, Dario. Come back to you in a sec. This is where Nathan Hyde came in. Nathan's a cider maker or a perry maker. How are you, Nathan?
Yeah, really good, thanks.
How did you get involved in this?
I used to work with a gentleman in a previous life who was a brewer and came across Sam Pendergast, who has been a member of the co-op for a couple of years now.
Hmm.
And Craig pointed Sam my way, and next thing you know, I had a phone call from Liz Cameron, who's the chair of the GV Food Co-op.
Yeah.
And he just asked if I'd help them develop and manage the project of putting some pears to good use.
So, and you had to get a wriggle on, by the sound of things.
We had to move pretty quickly, yes. Yeah. I managed to ask Dario what the Brix levels were in the pears, and they were quite high, so we had to...
And Brix is a sugar level rating, really. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So we had to really get a wriggle on and book in a slot to press them and kick off ferment.
How quick did this all happen?
Oh, we pressed at the end of August. We were finished about the second week of September, and then we had a packing slot booked in, which got pushed out for another week. So we had to store the cider in 1,000-litre palacons and make sure it was at less than 3 degrees,
yeah,
because the product had been filtered. And then we got our pack slot, and away we went. So really, turnaround has been sort of 4 to 5 weeks.
And so how did this all happen? Because 4 to 5 weeks, this would normally, to get a product up from scratch... What, years? A year or more, normally?
Yeah. Yeah. Look, in a previous role that I was involved with, we managed to get a cider to market in about 4 months, which was just unheard of.
And now you've done it in 5 weeks.
Now we've done it in 5 weeks.
So. Were you just drawing in favours from all over the place?
I was cashing in a few, yeah. I mean, there's acknowledgements on the back of the label, but certainly the guys that got behind us and helped us get our slots.
Yeah. Okay. So, Dario, these pears were pretty ripe by the time this was happening?
Yeah. I did mention to Les that we had to probably move pretty quick. They had already sort of been in storage for 3 to 4 weeks sort of thing, so their use by was getting towards the end. So,
but can't you store pears for a long time?
Yeah, you can, but we'd already opened our room up and we were getting to the tail end, so this is the last run. And yeah, that the room had basically already been open for probably about 6 weeks. So, in actual fact, they've probably been in there for about 7 or 8 weeks.
Okay. So, Nathan, from a cider maker's point of view, what are the challenges? I guess I think high sugar means high alcohol.
Yeah,
potentially.
Correct. And that was what I was really alarmed about. Was at 15 Brix, we're potentially heading for a high alcohol pear cider, which is virtually unheard of.
Yeah. You lose your marketing advantage then, don't you?
You do. You do. It's exactly right. Once we'd pressed, I actually did a slower ferment on this, a slightly cooler ferment, so that we actually finished at 1.5 Brix. So it still had a little bit of residual sweetness, but we managed to control the alcohols. And by the time we'd finished blending, we'd finished with a product at 4.5%.
So you got it down to what you wanted.
We got it down.
Now, me and Tony Allen and I, my mother would pull me up there, were calling it Perry earlier. You say we don't call it Perry in Australia.
No, I call it pear cider, but I know that my friends in the Harcourt Valley there, Drew Henry, would pull me up and say it's Perry. But Perry is English terminology and utilising Perry pears, which we don't have in Australia. So, well, there's a few planted, but not enough for commercial usage.
Yeah, okay. So these are pears of the Goulburn Valley. Can we? I'll open this. I'll
Please see if, do.
Yeah. And what should I have to admit that I'm not cider's not a drink of choice normally. So what should I just get that off?
Sounded good.
So it's got fizz by the sound of it.
Has.
You've got one there, and I've got one here. Oh, the colour's quite pink, isn't it?
It is pink.
Yeah.
So this is the reason it's a tad pink is because the final juice that we used in the blend. Once you get a bit of skin contact, it's like wine grapes. Once you get a bit of skin contact, you can actually extract a little bit of colour. And then obviously holding it in palacons for a couple of weeks really aided in drawing out that colour. So it has come out a little bit pink, of which the GV Food Co-op has said to me that batch number 2 has to be the same. I'm not sure we can replicate that. Hope you can help there, Dario.
So I'll just try some now. There's definitely the pear flavour there, but it's not overly sweet at all, is it? It's quite surprising, actually, how you get that taste of pear and then it's the sweetness.
No sweetness. Yeah. Look, what we aim to do is to produce a cider that would have a dry finish. So there was no residual sugar added to this ferment at all.
Mm-hmm.
So basically this was just pear juice and yeast.
Yeah.
And that's it.
This could be dangerous on a hot afternoon. This stuff.
Very much so.
Dario, yeah, I should say, I'm talking here with Dario Pulsoni, who's a fruit grower at Kyabram in northern Victoria, and also Nathan Hyde, who's a cider maker. And we're discussing how pear cider is now being made in the Goulburn Valley, or a new pear cider, because otherwise the pears were going to go to waste because SPC didn't want them anymore. Dario, what's the reaction been to this in the area?
Yeah, look, it's been quite good. I've had a lot of other growers ringing me up, or if when I've seen them sort of asking, you know, how's it going? You know, where's it at? And you know, they're quite interested. So yeah, no, there has been quite a lot of interest shown in it.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. Is it local businesses supporting it?
Yeah, there is local businesses supporting it, but it's also when you say local businesses, it's quite a expanded area that are going to support it, yeah.
Okay, so will you keep it going? Is it a one-off, one season's fruit, or do you keep going with it?
No. We intend on keeping going with it. In actual fact, I think we're already looking at doing our second run. So, we definitely want to keep it going.
Yeah. Nathan, where can something like this go? Because we hear that cider, it's been said for a while now, cider's in fashion or has been quite trendy. Is it going to come off? Is it going to be out of favour again in years ahead? Or does something like this provide a long-term option for fruit growers?
Well, Cameron, good question, because through to 17-18, we're anticipating doubling cider drinking as to what it is today. So as a share of market, it'll
doubling?
Doubling again.
Mm. Wow.
As a share of market, it could push through to 5% of the overall beverage market, which is quite substantial.
What are you doing, pinching the white wine market?
A little bit of white wine, RTD market. Yeah. It's. I mean, the good thing with it is that you could actually stand in a venue and have a couple of glasses of this, and not that I condone drinking and driving, but you could actually drive after having a couple, whereas you can only have one glass of wine. So, and in reality, it's a pear wine or an apple wine.
Yeah.
So it's made with the same processes and theories behind it. So look, the potential of it's huge.
I've got to go easy on this. I'm just drinking. What is it? It's not even midday yet. Dario, other growers, are they interested?
Definitely. Like I say, I've had people, other growers, calling me or stop me in the street and that, and asking me, you know, is it going to be a one-off thing, or you're going to keep it going? And there has been a lot of interest. There's people ask me, you know, if you want, I've got pears available. So. Definitely the growers want to get it behind it.
So, Nathan, could you work with most of the pears in the region, or is there quite specific requirements that you work with?
No, we can work with all of them, to be honest. There's no particular pear that's better than the other. I mean, ideally, we want to try and replicate flavour, and I think one of the things that you have to do with cider is gain consistency and make sure that the product tastes pretty similar to the way it did the first time around.
Yep. So, which is one of your challenges in this
indeed.
Case.
Indeed, yeah. And I mean, look, I hang on to retention samples, and I think the secret in cider, I shouldn't really blurt it out, but I think it comes down to the blending and the quality of the fruit. It's exactly the same as winemaking. Dario produces grapefruit, and so do the growers in the valley. So,
yeah.
I can't see any challenges moving forward. But
the Melbourne foodie set love this sort of stuff, don't they?
Love it. Yeah. I mean, the brand's got provenance and a story behind it. Yeah. I think, you know, it really has. I mean, it sort of captured the imagination a little bit.
Yeah. Dario, do you feel that there's a, I don't know if sympathy is the right word to use here, but there is definitely an element in the southern part of Australia of a public awareness of your cause and the other growers' cause and the problems that you face there. Do you think that helps you in this instance?
Oh, look, definitely. I think it does. You only have to look at, all the advertising and in the papers about people, growers pulling trees out. It's all over the news, and I think probably the two majors have picked up on that, and now they're actually going to start stocking only Australian fruit in their cans. So if that's had an impact on the two majors, obviously there's been a fair bit of pressure from the consumers.
Mm. So you must be feeling a fair bit better than you were a couple of months back at this point.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, now, especially after trying the product too.
Were you a cider man before?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, I actually converted over probably a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Started drinking cider. So, yeah, no, I like a cider.
Oh, well, they say if you can work in what you love for a living, you sort it, eh?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Now, Nathan, as the cider maker, this fits into the new world category of ciders, does
yeah,
it?
Yeah,
it's
very
made
much
in the
so.
New world, I guess.
Yeah, look, and we don't hide that fact, Cameron. It's you know, it is made in new world style. I mean, Australian cider is about, you know, being fresh and fruit driven, and hopefully, you know, the consumer will look at this and say that is a really enjoyable product, as they should with cider.
What is the difference between a new world cider and an old world cider?
Old world ciders can use specific fruit. So, for example, out of the UK, you know, there's hundreds of apple varieties and quite a number of pear varieties that you can use, and they tend to give a very different flavour. The style of English cider is very different in the way that it's made. It's treated differently.
I had some in Devon, and it tasted like flat, warm apple juice.
Yeah, look, I must confess, if you sit me down with both styles, I'd happily drink New World over Old World.
All right. I know the Cider Awards are on again at the moment, aren't they? So,
yeah, judging takes place today and tomorrow, and the winners get announced next week.
You win it? You win the...
We managed to scramble our entry in at the very last minute.
Yeah. All right. Well, good luck with the awards. And Dario, good luck with your new life as a pear grower.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot to both of you for coming in today. Yeah, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Nathan Hyde, who's a cider maker, and Dario Pulsoni, who's a fruit grower at Kyabram and now grows fruit for the cider business. Interesting story. Good story. Good news story coming out of the Goulburn Valley. Animals that have become extinct usually become the stuff of legends. Think of the Tassie tiger or the dodo or the moa, New Zealand's equivalent of the emu. But I'm not sure that that'll happen to an animal in northern Australia that's really, unfortunately, it looks like it's about to become extinct. On Christmas Island, there lives the last known forest skink, the only one left, and her name is Gump. Gump is doted on and closely watched by Samantha Flakis. Gump's keeper, Samantha, joins me now, the Natural Resources Manager at the Christmas Island National Park. Hi, Samantha.
Hi, Cameron. How are you going?
Good. Is it right to say Gump's the last of her kind?
Well, we believe that she probably is the last of her kind, or the forest skink is in such low densities in the wild that they're just unable to be detected these days. So we've done a lot of monitoring surveys over the years, particularly in the last decade. A lot of effort has been put in to try and search for the forest skink, and particularly in the last few years, the numbers have significantly dropped to the point where we are now not seeing the forest skink out in the wild. So, yeah, I mean, it's quite possible that Gump is the last one of her kind. Yeah,
that's quite a sad thought, isn't it? Really sad thought.
Yeah, it is, and. You know, I'm not sure whether you have an understanding of what Christmas Island is all about. So, you know, it's a very, very unique island that has a lot of endemic species, so species that are only found here and nowhere else in the world, which have evolved over millions of years and created this very unique ecosystem here. And the forest skink is a part of that uniqueness. And to see that disappear from the environment here there's quite a sense of loss. You know, we've lost a unique species from a what we believe is a really unique environment. So, yeah, it is a little bit sad.
Are we talking about a species that's been in existence for thousands of years, tens of thousands of years?
Oh, I can't really answer that. Probably much longer than that. I mean, you know, the species here on the island have probably evolved for millions of years before, you know, the island was settled. And, you know, within the last 100 years, we've seen a lot of change on the island with, various introduced species that have impacted on, you know, the native wildlife here. And because they have evolved without predators and competitors over this, you know, millions of years, thousands of years, then, you know, they're very susceptible to any changes, you know, in their environment. So, yeah, I mean, we've seen quite a change over that that period of, you know, the last 100 years, with, you know, other animals being introduced to the island that have posed challenges, I guess, for the native species that are here.
We've got a picture of Gump up on the Bush Telly Facebook page, those really distinctive ear holes on the side. Can you describe the lizard for us?
Yeah, look, it's quite a large skink, and it's the largest skink that we did or do have on the island, compared to another smaller skink, the blue-tailed skink. The forest skink is very bronze in colour. It grows to about maybe around 20 centimetres in length, and it's quite a thick-set little skink as well. So, you know, here in this environment, it was quite distinct, distinctly different from any of the other native reptiles, because it was much bigger in size and, you know, had that brilliant bronze colour as well.
Mm. Tell me more about the predators. What are the problem animals?
Okay, there's no one thing that we can point our finger to say this has caused the decline of our native reptiles. The types of animals or the types of things that we think are impacting on, you know, the forest skink as well as other natives here on the island is things like the Asian wolf snake. This snake was accidentally introduced probably around about the late 80s and probably through shipping, you know, bringing cargo to the island. And it's a reptile specialist, so it actually predates, it eats other reptiles. So we
one of the worst things you could have turn up on the island, by the sound of it.
Absolutely. So we think, you know, that's played a significant role in the decline. So as it's moved across the island, it has, you know, wiped out, you know, the native reptiles as it's moved. But it's not that in isation. You know, there's other things like...
You've got crazy ants there, don't you?
We've got yellow crazy ants, yes. We've got centipedes, we've got rats. So there's a whole, you know, basket of invasive species here that's impacting on the reptiles in particular.
Centipedes are a problem, are they?
Well, they are a problem on the island. It's thought that, you know, around about the 90s, their abundance increased quite considerably, but we don't know what sort of role they play in the decline of the reptiles. I mean, they're probably using the same or similar microhabitat as the skinks. So, you know, whether that is a competition or a predatory impact, we don't really know. And they're the sort of things that we're looking to investigate further, particularly because we've got two other species that we have in captivity that we're breeding successfully that we hope to one day reintroduce back into the wild. So while we are maintaining a captive breeding program, we're trying to investigate and also mitigate, obviously, the threats that, you know, have caused their decline so that we can put them back into, you know, an environment that, you know, they're able to sort of maintain or self-sustain or have a viable population, you know, over the long term.
Samantha Plakis is Natural Resource Manager at the Christmas Island National Park. We're discussing Gump, the last known forest skink on the island. Do you know how old Gump is?
Oh, I have no idea. I wouldn't be able to tell you that. I mean, she was caught from the wild back in 2009, and I'm not sure how old she was.
There's no sort of test then. You can do to identify their age or anything?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Yeah. She had a couple of friends to begin with. What happened to them?
Yeah, she did. So back in 2009, there was quite an effort put in to catch a number of different species, so and the forest skink was one of them, and the other two were the Lister's geckos and the blue-tailed skinks, to try and bring them into captivity. And Gump was one of three forest skinks that were caught at the time, and all three of them were females, so we couldn't actually start up a breeding colony, obviously, with three females. The other two forest skinks that we did have were unfortunately found a hole in the enclosure that we were unaware of, which led them into a section of the enclosure that they couldn't turn around and get out. So by the time we had found them, they had unfortunately perished. But
three left and two of them got out or got to the wrong spot.
So
knowing you're the caretaker of what is thought to be the last of these forest skinks, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, like I said earlier, I think, you know, there's a real sense of loss for us here to see, you know, quite a unique species disappear from, you know, our environment here. And, I mean, you know, it's obviously sad to see that that's, you know, it's come to that. But, you know, what I can say, though, is that, you know, I feel confident that we have put in as much effort that we possibly can to try and secure the future of the species. So while it's, you know, it is a sad thing to have the last one, you know, I'm very confident that we've done
all you can. Samantha, thank you for joining us today. Samantha Plagas, Natural Resource Manager at the Christmas Island National Park. That's Bush Telly for today. Tomorrow, we'll have blues performer Wolf Male and we'll speak about the auction of a very famous pair of shears. That and more tomorrow on Bush Telly.
On the health report, there's a special feature on futile treatment.
It was very painful, very invasive, no dignity. This was a man who had no chance of long-term survival.
Futile care costs the nation a fortune and people and their families a lot in terms of avoidable pain. And doctors don't accept it for themselves. There's nothing futile about the health report. Why not download a podcast from Radio National's website?